Hi everyone, welcome back to Carry the One Radio. My name is Cindy, and this is the fifth installment of our Young Scientist Spotlight series, where we highlight early career scientists in a more informal manner than our regular episodes. Today's episode features Jen Perlstein, a PhD candidate in clinical psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. We talked about her research in understanding how stress affects decision-making, how she's working to develop a model of accessible mental health care, and the challenges that she faces as a scientist with a disability. This episode also features a lengthy discussion about accessibility issues in academia and how to talk about them. We learned a lot when we talked to Jen, and we hope that you will too.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Yeah, my name is Jen Perlstein. I am a fifth year graduate student in the clinical science area at UC Berkeley. And broadly, my research focuses on how stress influences our ability to make decisions and regulate our behavior.
What does it mean to be a PhD in clinical sciences?
So in addition to doing, you know, a master's thesis and a PhD and all of those components that are, I think, fairly typical in graduate PhD types of programs, I am also doing training to be able to work directly with clinical populations. So what this looks like is receiving specific training to be able to do therapy and do assessments like neurocognitive evaluations, that sort of work to help people deal with mental health challenges or some type of neurological or cognitive impairment.
Wouldn't that be the same as like a PsyD?
A PsyD is a doctorate in psychology, and that does not involve any type of extensive research training. And so there's a lot more of that kind of therapy and assessment type of work and a lot less of conducting actual laboratory experiments. Whereas those of us in PhD programs tend to do the same degree of rigorous research training as in any other type of PhD program, we just add that clinical training on top of it.
So does it take a lot longer?
So here at Berkeley, for example, I think the average PhD in the other areas of psychology, like cognition or neuroscience, those programs tend to be about 5 years, maybe 6 years. For clinical students, however, we also have the privilege of having a required 1 year full-time internship after we do all of our PhD requirements. That serves kind of similarly as like a residency for med school. That 1 year internship is like our full-time clinical experience before we can officially get our PhD. So what that means is that for myself, for example, I'm planning to be in residence here at Berkeley for 6 years and then do my 1 year internship. So I will complete my PhD in 7 years. That's fairly typical for research-oriented programs.
I know that you've already done some clinical work. So would the internship basically be like what you did then, just full-time and with more patients?
While we are graduate students here in residence, it's much more constrained clinical training. I would say on average, especially at a program like Berkeley that is so much more research focused, we're really only spending about a day a week, maybe 2 days a week doing our clinical work. So for example, when I was working in San Francisco at the General, I was there for a day and a half per week. And so I only had a handful of cases that I was monitoring or working with. Whereas in that full year clinical internship training, that is 9-to-5 type of structure, and typically you carry a full caseload. But the idea is that you're really a full-time clinician during that year. Whereas right now, I feel like I'm more like a full-time researcher that does like a little half day doing clinical work.
What's the specific project mm-hmm. that you're doing right now?
Yeah, so I'm working on a lot of specific projects right now, as opposed to just one. But I guess broad strokes, the kind of core theme of my research has been trying to understand how it is that stress makes us make decisions that we may later regret. So for myself, for example, let's say I am trying to have healthier meals and I have prepped salads for the week. So every night of the week, I have a meal like ready for me at home. I'm going to eat healthy, have all my veggies. And then it's really, really stressful. My research mentor gives me negative feedback. I've had some really bad sessions with a client. I'm not going to go home and eat that healthy salad. I am going to like pick up a pint of ice cream on my way home and have that for dinner. This is something that most people can kind of anecdotally relate to, of like, oh yeah, when I'm stressed out, I do things that are not aligned with my long-term goal. And that's something that I'm trying to understand: what are the neurocognitive processes that lead to that? And specifically, what individual differences in this tendency means for psychopathological outcomes. I'm looking at these processes of how it is that stress may be influencing cognitive functioning. And the way that I'm doing that is I'm bringing in participants who have a wide range experiences with mental health. So depression, anxiety, substance use, really any type of mental health experience. And I am running them through a cognitive task that includes a stress induction. And what I'm looking at specifically is how sensitive their working memory capacity, which is a specific aspect of cognitive ability, how sensitive that is to the experience of stress. So what happens is they come in the lab, they get strapped up to all sorts of physiological data collection equipment. So I look at how much their palms are sweating when they're experiencing stress. I'm looking at how much their pupils are dilating or constricting, because that also corresponds with how aroused you are. And so I'm looking at these different physiological indices while they complete this fairly lengthy, fairly arduous cognitive task. And during this task, they're given feedback that they're doing very poorly at different points in order to elicit stress. So of course, this is not true feedback. We are in fact using deception, but we tell them that we're comparing their performance to other people who are age and gender matched, and we're giving them this fake performance that they're doing really poorly. We tell them to speed up to, again, try to perform better, and then we monitor their performance over time. And one of the things that I'm really excited about with this particular task is it's a novel task that I programmed myself, so it's never been done before. I'm the first one to test whether this actually works, but it's also cool because I'm able to stress them out in the task. So a lot of the work that looks at how it is that cognitive functioning is sensitive to something like stress or arousal, most of this research will do a task and then stress you out and then do the task again. The problem with that is that typically in laboratory inductions of mood, people don't feel that way for very long. When you feel stressed out in the lab, it's not quite the same as being stressed out in real life. It usually dissipates pretty quickly. And so this is a way to really capture that peak period of stress and arousal and see whether that degree of physiological activation influences some of these cognitive processes. So I'm in the process of circling through like 100 some odd people to do this particular study to map out whether this is a way of understanding who is most sensitive to experiencing this kind of emotion-related impulsivity.
What do they think they're coming in for?
So we tell them that we are doing some general thinking tasks, and we tell them when they're doing this cognitive task that it is a measure of memory, which is true, and we simply tell them that we're giving them this feedback to try to improve their performance. So they think that they're simply doing this cognitive battery.
Do any of them ever catch on to the fact that, you know, this is a laboratory experiment? Inherently, something's like a little bit funky about this?
Yes. So we do ask participants afterward the extent to which they thought this had to do with stress. In this particular study, most people are buying into the task. They do think that the feedback is accurate. It's also a very hard task. And so it is reasonable that they would be performing poorly and getting the feedback that they're performing poorly. In other studies where I've used an undergraduate sample, they tend to catch on to this a little bit more quickly, that we are in fact looking at, say, like a stress-related process. And I think that's because typically when we do studies in undergraduates, they are psychology students and they have heard of a lot of the paradigms that we're using in the lab. Though I will add, the most interesting part of this is even when people know that the study is about stress, they still feel stressed. Like their body still exhibits all of the same indices, like the same types of activation. So it doesn't really matter whether you know it's about stress or not, you're still going to feel stressed by it and you will still have the same type of decrements in your cognitive performance.
Have you done the test?
I have. And it is awful.
So what is the actual like working memory test that they're doing?
Yeah, so the specific task that I'm using is referred to as the NBAC. It's one of the most widely used types of working memory tasks where people are asked to remember an N or a number back. For this task, I'm doing a two-back task. So if I were to give you the letters A, B, C, on the letter C, you would be expected to remember the letter A, which would be not one letter back, but two letters back.
And you have controls as well.
So we are actually not looking at healthy controls at all. Instead, we're looking at these dimensional indices of psychopathology. So we're not looking at how do we characterize someone who is depressed versus someone who is not depressed. Instead, we're looking at how do we characterize the degree of depression that someone is experiencing or the degree of anxiety that someone is experiencing. And because we're collecting a sample that has all of these diverse forms of psychopathology, there are people who have no depression. There are people who have a ton of depression. There are people who have no substance abuse. There are people who have a lot. And so even though we don't have healthy controls, we do have comparisons on these dimensional measures that we're interested in.
And so during this task, you're collecting all of these physiological measurements, which are objective. But then how do you control for how subjects are reporting their own levels of, say, depression or anxiety, right? Because obviously that's very subjective, but you do need that subjective reporting to know how they're feeling in the first place.
We do multi-method evaluations of how people are experiencing symptoms. And so what that means is we do self-report, and the measures that we use are well-validated, widely used types of measures that do have a decent degree of sensitivity and specificity for determining these types of mental health considerations. But as you're alluding to, there's still bias. There's still ways in which self-report is not the most ideal measure. So we have an advanced clinical graduate student do a diagnostic interview with participants where we go through every type of mental health condition and have, you know, clinician-rated diagnostic labels. And things like suicidality, we don't trust just self-report. We also have a clinical interviewer doing those evaluations.
So people, I would imagine, have different sensitivity to being told that they're doing poorly, mm-hmm. right? Like, I can imagine I'd be extremely stressed out if mm-hmm. someone told me I was doing worse than other people.
Mm-hmm.
But are there people who, you know, their stress response is lower if this is a less mm-hmm. stressful intervention for them?
Yeah. I think this is a great point that there are plenty of other variables that would influence the extent to which somebody is sensitive to this type of feedback. And that's part of what I want to understand is who is most likely to experience this particular stressor as something that's leading to not just this physiological reactivity, but also leading to some of these cognitive declines.
And then how unique is it to include people who have had mental health experiences mm-hmm. in a task like this? I think mm-hmm. a lot of psychology research is done expressly in people who have not mm-hmm. had any, you know, mental health diagnoses yeah. or experiences.
Yeah, so I think this is why I'm really excited by this particular field, is that in clinical science, we're allowed to steal all the methods from all the other types of psychology that are doing the sophisticated cognitive tests and the sophisticated social experiments. And we can say, hey, that's cool in like normal people who have normal functioning. We're going to take that and see how that actually goes awry in people who are experiencing mental health symptoms. And so I think it is pretty novel, this particular type of paradigm that I'm using. I mean, I already bragged that I'm the one who wrote it, so no one else has done it. But aside from that piece, in terms of doing these types of very rigorous cognitive tasks in a clinical sample, it's something that's being done, I would say, pretty widely. But I think the kind of unique ways of adding in the extra layers of some of these physiological indices, for example, it's something that, like in our department, we have maybe like one or two labs that are doing this type of work. So it's not necessarily like all clinical scientists are really pursuing this type of basic science question, but it's certainly being done.
These are all chronic conditions. Do you see subjects more than once?
So for the context of this particular study, we do bring them in for several sessions. So I'm speaking about kind of my particular piece of this broader project, but we're looking at other facets of executive functioning. We're looking at other types of emotional processing. We're actually doing brain scans on these folks. And so those are all different sessions. It would be way too tiring to try to do all of this in a single session. And so we do require that we complete all of those sessions in a fairly limited time window because symptoms change over time. And so we're trying to capture cross-sectionally at a single point in time, given this current level of symptoms, what are the kind of current cognitive impairments or cognitive changes as a function of that. But I would absolutely imagine if we were to look at these folks, you know, 6 months later, a year later, it could look very different. And some of that may be based on symptoms. It could be based on a lot of other lifestyle considerations. But in this case, we're trying to limit those confounds and only look at this particular moment in time.
And are subjects on medications?
Yeah, so participants are on medications. We do exclude for medications that would be particularly like drowsiness inducing. And so some antipsychotics, for example, we exclude. But for, you know, SSRIs, like antidepressants, we don't exclude. I think the area that I'm most jazzed about moving into is trying to people's daily lives. So both by doing measurements, for example, on people's smartphones while they're like out navigating their daily lives in the community, but also doing intervention-based work. And so a project that I have been working on is an intervention designed to treat self-harm, so suicide or non-suicidal self-injury, to treat that with an online intervention. This is something that's pretty novel because typically clinicians are kind of scared of people who have high rates of self-harm. It's a fairly risky population, and I think as a therapist, it's like one of my greatest fears is that one of my clients will end up completing suicide while under my care. And so it's been a fascinating study to put together because we have these risk considerations. We know this is a very vulnerable population, and also suicide rates are going up year after year. We are not appropriately addressing suicide, and so access to care is a huge barrier. And so we have been working alongside several other care providers to figure out how can we create an online intervention that teaches really basic skills like emotion regulation skills, walking away when feeling too heated, some basic strategies that have been shown across a wide range of empirical interventions to be really helpful for people who have self-harm. How do we deliver that in a way that is still understanding of kind of the vulnerabilities and the sensitivities of this population? And so our kind of first foray into this is on the UC Berkeley campus. We're working with the College Healthcare Center, the Tang Center here, to provide this online intervention as an adjunctive treatment in addition to what it is that they're already receiving as in-person care, to make sure like this is something that is acceptable, it's something that's feasible, and really to do this kind of initial piloting before we take it to other communities and to other settings. And so I'm really excited about this because it's obviously important to try to address the suicide rate, sure, but it's also something that I feel really passionate about is improving access to care, because it's great that we have all of these well-designed, empirically supported interventions that are being done in the ivory tower institutions across the country, but that's not reaching the vast majority of people who are having mental health challenges. And so I'm excited to work with technology to try to improve access and get people the type of care that we know works in a way that may be a bit more attainable or easier for folks.
So there are apps like BetterHelp, I mm-hmm. think, and the online therapy, mm-hmm. the ones where, I guess
it's like Talkspace, BetterHelp, there are a few of them.
But yours isn't meant to be having a clinician on call mm-hmm. when you're feeling, it's not meant to be like a text-based therapy session.
Yeah, so what's fairly unique about this is that we are trying to actually eliminate the clinician if possible, because that would then, of course, improve access because it's free and there's no one who has to monitor it. And so what's different about this intervention is all of the content is like text and image based. So we have it all programmed up online. And so you're literally like clicking through web pages and doing worksheets on the computer to interact with the intervention. So yeah, there's no clinician. Whereas in programs like BetterHelp or Talkspace or something like that, you still have a therapist. This would be replacing that therapist and instead just delivering the skills.
And so is the idea to prevent moments of crisis in people who maybe aren't symptomatic yet?
In this case, we're interested in trying to replace what we're kind of deeming as clinicians as maladaptive behavior. So things like self-injury, cutting, although that can be an effective strategy in the short term of like you are feeling really intense emotions, you don't know what to do, what do? You try to hurt yourself, and then that makes the emotions feel better. That is kind of a typical process for somebody who engages in routine self-injury. If someone is injuring themselves regularly, I mean, that is still a behavior that we would want to help them work on. And so we aren't really seeing it as a moment of crisis if they're engaging in that type of routine behavior, because it's something that they may be doing all the time. But we would still want to help them during that moment. That said, like we are trying to help kind of like at any point in time for somebody who has a tendency towards self-harm. So if somebody has previously attempted suicide, they would be a good candidate for this type of intervention. And we are still looking at people who are in pretty acute phases. So having had like a prior attempt within the past year, that doesn't mean that they are literally in the hospital recovering, but that is still a very high risk period for engaging in that behavior again. And so it's not like we take people when they're like doing great. We're still taking people during these periods of relative stress strain or crisis. But yeah, we're hoping that this can be a tool that can still be helpful during those periods. Obviously, I mean, my dream would be that everyone has a full care team with a social worker and a psychiatrist and a therapist and all of that. But knowing that that isn't a realistic possibility for many people, I think this could be a viable tool to help those who don't have access to that type of care.
Is it a functional website right now? Like, do you have a group of people who are beta testing it?
Yeah, so we're in the pilot phase right now. It's not something that I can, release the URL for or anything, because right now we are still working directly with our participants as clinicians. So right now we're doing it with people who are on the UC Berkeley campus who can do phone calls with trained clinicians to check in to see, how is this going for you? Is this working well? Do you need additional care, et cetera? And so it's not in a phase where we are quite ready to say, it is a standalone intervention, but we're trying to prove that right now. So hopefully in a few years, we'll have it as something that is out and available.
Questions we like to ask are what you dislike the most about your research and what you love the most about your research, but then I also want to ask the same question about your clinical work.
What I hate most about my research? I think one of the challenges of being in kind of a clinical science area is that I am borrowing methods from all of these different disciplines, and at times I don't quite feel like an expert in the methods that I'm employing. And that is true whether it's, statistical methods, physiological methods, et cetera. I kind of feel like I'm picking and borrowing and putting together in this novel way, and I'm not really sure all the time if the way that I'm combining them actually works and is still, valid to the ways in which some of these tasks were originally conceptualized or put together by the experts in those kind of disparate disciplines. That said, it is one of the things I love about research as well, that I get to collaborate and I get to borrow ideas and share ideas and work with scholars in these different areas. So while at times I find that kind of feeling very unsure of what I'm doing and if it's going to work and all of that, it can be very frustrating. That's also part of what's really exciting about research, because we get to ask these questions and be really curious and wildly unsure about what's going to come of it. So I guess what I hate and I love are the exact same thing.
Good answer.
Yeah.
What about your clinical work?
For clinical work, I would say the thing that I hate about clinical work is that progress is non-linear and oftentimes wildly unrelated to what it is that I am doing as the therapist. And so it can be really challenging sometimes to be working with a client and week after week, nothing is getting better, things are getting worse, and I just don't know what to do. And that can be a very discouraging process at times, because as a therapist, I'm only working with a client 1 hour during the week. They have 167 other hours of the week to do whatever the heck they want. And therefore, sometimes that 1 hour of therapy doesn't make a dent in what it is that they're dealing with. And that can be something that's really difficult, to feel wildly ineffective as a therapist, but also to feel like the work that we're doing in session can't change some of the larger systems that are contributing to poor mental health outcomes. An example of this would be last year I was working at the San Francisco General Hospital, and I was working with a lot of people who had experienced a great deal of trauma, and immigration-related trauma in particular. And with those types of stresses and strains, I can teach you strategies to cope with stress. We can talk about emotions, sure, but at a certain point, I can only do so much when the broader social and political context is providing so much stress and strain that I often feel kind of powerless in that type of context of, I'm not even making a dent in what it is that is impacting how these people are functioning. And so that can feel very difficult, that I am one small piece of a broader system that, I can't change the whole system. And that's discouraging. In terms of what I love, though, I feel so privileged that people are willing to share their lives with me as a therapist. The fact that they feel like I can be someone who can help them, and to be able to have that human connection. I'm sure many listeners have heard that loneliness is on the rise. We are in kind of this epidemic of people lacking social connection, and to have the privilege of connecting with someone on some of these really profoundly painful and emotional types of experiences, it's empowering and powerful. And to not only be able to connect with someone in this way, but to be able to partner with them to make their lives better. Truly, I feel like there's no greater privilege than to be able to provide that for someone. And so that's something that I absolutely adore about clinical work.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about today is that you experience a particular type of discrimination in grad school slash academia that a lot of people might not be aware of. And so could you talk about your situation and the types of challenges that you face?
Yeah, so I have a visual impairment that is a form of early onset macular degeneration that has led me to be legally blind. I make that distinction because I often don't navigate with a cane, and I think many people who meet me would think that I am sighted. However, when I look directly at anything, it totally disappears.
Is it genetic? Is it inherited?
It is, yeah.
And it's earlier onset, right, than most people experience it.
Yeah.
And then I guess, and you don't have to answer this question, but it's progressive, right? And
yeah.
So there's, how do you deal with kind of knowing it's going
yeah.
to be more, you know, difficult to navigate?
Yeah, so I am privileged in that the progressive form of this illness tends to be such that you have a pretty quick progression of losing vision and then you plateau. So most people by about their kind of like mid to late 20s are at a plateau and then their vision stays pretty stable until late in life. So the last, I don't know, 4 years approximately, my vision has been stable. And so I am very hopeful that my vision will stay at this place until I deal with more age-related decline. But that was absolutely something when I was first diagnosed as a teenager, I was like, excuse me, what? Like, you can't tell me when it's going to progress, how it's going to progress, what it's going to look like nothing. And so that uncertainty was really challenging. But I think the other piece of this that has made it easier is that like at a certain point, like I just couldn't see enough that I had to adapt. Like if I were to lose more vision now, I feel like I have the tools and strategies to deal with not having vision. So I think the harder part was going from being sighted to being partially sighted. Whereas now I am well connected with, you know, resources and the community. And I feel like I know what I could do if I were to lose more sight. Whereas when I was first diagnosed, that was not the case. And so as a student who is blind, what that means is I require a lot of accommodations. And that is true in the classroom and outside of the classroom. And it's something that has been, I would say, fairly difficult to navigate in a graduate school context where there's not kind of like a formal process of how do you accommodate lab time? How do you accommodate clinical work? There aren't very formal systems for those types of accommodations. And it's something where there aren't a lot of students who have navigated this terrain. And so it's very hard, I think, to find mentorship or to find any type of precedence for these types of challenges. So I would say I experience ableism on a regular basis as a graduate student.
Does that ableism manifest mostly in the like having to fight to get accommodations, or is it casual remarks that you hear?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I would say it is all of the above. I will share my, I think, example horror story of graduate school, which is definitely not, you know, the type of response I've gotten from most people. But my first year in graduate school, I was taking an assessment course, which is where you learn how to do things like IQ testing, personality testing, etc. And the unfortunate reality is many of these tests are primarily visual. The stimuli are visual stimuli. And so if you are going to be the psychometrician who is doing this assessment, you have to be able to see how somebody is responding in the room in real time. And you have to be able to do this type of administration in a quick way that like adheres to the validity, which basically means like you say all of the words in the exact order that they need to be said, that sort of thing. And this is something that, I mean, I simply cannot do that. It's not going to be possible. That is just a limitation. And so when I was in this course, I was trying to work with the faculty member to figure out what are other ways of, for me, receiving the training to be competent in assessment, while also knowing that there are certain neurocognitive assessments that I simply cannot administer. And the faculty member said to me, there is no way you can be a clinical psychologist if you cannot administer these assessments. I mean, I'm in grad school for this whole clinical psychology thing, so I don't know if you're telling me I can't have a career in this field. So that, I think, is a more flagrant example of, I wouldn't even call it a microaggression. Like, in that case, I think it was a pretty forceful, like, discriminatory type of statement. Exactly. But I would say, like, other comments that are kind of like lower grade than that come up all the time. I think the biggest obstacle is getting accommodation. So I can't read standard print material. Anything that's on paper, it's not going to work for me, which means if I'm going to be in a meeting, I need to have a digital copy. If I, basically any setting, I would need to have some alternative format. And getting people to respect that need is very challenging. And so I have colleagues that I've worked with for 5, 6, 7 years who I still have to remind every single meeting. And I mean, there's nothing kind of inherently offensive about that, besides that, like, I would hope that that person could see me more fully and understand that this is a need that I have. But yeah, I think that is kind of the more common way in which this has been a challenge, as well as people simply like not understanding and making assumptions about what I can and cannot do. So, for example, being in courses where there's an expectation that we read content out loud. That's not going to work for me. Or saying like, oh, I'm going to put this all up on the board and I expect you to read these vignettes and rate them or something. I can't do that. So things like that where I need to assert myself often. I would say that's, I guess, kind of the most common way in which I encounter that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that has anything to do with like presentation? Maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think like visible versus invisible.
I think that's a huge part of it. So I spend a lot of time thinking about like the invisible versus visible disability distinction, particularly because my disability kind of crosses those bounds. Mm-hmm. I sometimes use a cane and I sometimes don't. And so the times that I'm using a cane, it's much more visible. And I would say that is also something that is inherently problematic because I don't think a lot of people understand that someone can have a disability that doesn't always require an assistive aid. And so I think that lack of awareness can lead to some assumptions being made of like, oh, you're using your cane today? Are you going more blind? What's happening? And I'm like, nope, it's just glary outside, you know? And so I think that is something that absolutely can lead to all sorts of challenges in that when it is invisible, certainly like people forget, people don't think about it, people overlook it. But when it's visible, I mean, there are, I would say, other ways in which discrimination happens when there is that kind of visible marker. I'm thinking of an example where I was applying for a funding mechanism that included diversity as a priority, and I was told by a colleague, make sure you bring your cane because we want them to see that you are representing a diverse background. And I mean, yes, I am representing a diverse background, and there's no other way for that to be made apparent. And also, like, I don't want to be instrumentalized in that way. And so I think it is tricky to have a disability that can kind of go across both of these categories. And I do think that the treatment differs across both. And unfortunately, I think there's stigma either way. Whether it's visible or invisible, there's just a different type of stigma.
Are there differences in how the general population treats you? A lot of what, you know, we encounter in science and research or the clinic is based on the assumption that we don't need accommodations like visual aids in your case. And so while those of us in the scientific community do have diverse backgrounds in terms of ethnicity, gender, identity, we are physically very similar, but that's not true in the general population.
Yes and no. It's interesting because I think the physical ability question is one that is, I think, especially challenging in the context of academia, where it's kind of like, how much can you produce? That's really what your value is. And so if you have something that gets in the way of your ability to produce more, like that arguably means that you're not really going to succeed in this area. And so I do think that there is kind of a unique challenge in the context of academia. I think, though, that as much as that is true about physical disability, I actually think it's worse with mental types of disability in academia in particular, because, like, theoretically, our minds are everything. And so if there is, you know, some type of mental health disorder or neurological condition, I think there's equal, if not greater, stigma in that context in academia as well. So I don't think it is, like, a unique privilege in physical disability to have this type of stigma. But to your question about the general population, because it's more of like a normal distribution, I guess, there's greater ignorance at times. I think I encounter far more aggressive forms of discrimination out in the world where, let's say, I'm walking home with my cane and someone decides to like physically drag me across the street, or I get a lot of kind of comments of like, oh, you look damn fine for a blind girl. I mean, just ignorant types of comments that I think that is more common in the general community than in academia. I think people generally are a bit more reserved in academic context and wouldn't necessarily engage in that type of way. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that there's greater representation in the general community. And so there is more accessibility in terms of like BART stations have audio markers and visual markers because they know that people are going to need both. Whereas that's not the case like in the psychology building that I work in. There is no Braille signage. There just isn't any type of real accessibility consideration for those who have visual impairments.
Or like ramps, you need ramp entrances to everything.
I could get on an accessibility soapbox for a really long time, but I will abstain from that right now.
What would you most like people to understand about your situation?
I think the thing that I would like people to most understand is that people come from all different walks of life and all different types of experiences. And I think oftentimes there is an assumption that we can understand something about a person by their visible presentation, so skin color, or whether they have a cane or a wheelchair or something like that. And I think what I have learned in my own lived experience with this, and frankly in doing clinical work, is that you can't judge somebody from their outsides, and you can't know what their abilities are, what their needs are, or even how to interact about those abilities and needs unless you ask the person. And so I think the piece that I would want people to know is, like, you can talk to me about it. If you are confused, if you don't know how to be accessible, if you are like, hey, I heard through the grapevine there's this thing that you're dealing with, like, can you explain it to me? Like, I would much rather have the clumsy, awkward, uncomfortable conversation than have no conversation. And so I think the drilled down version of this is knowing that everybody carries some type of unique background or lived experience that is worth exploring, because it's going to impact who they are and how they work. And so having a bit of openness to that human side of things, of like, hey, it's actually important for me to know what you can or cannot see and how that lived experience influences how you navigate the world, because that influences your research, that influences your clinical work. And I think oftentimes we're sort of like cogs in a machine, if you will. Like, the idea is like, just do the work, but we're all humans and we all have different needs and abilities. And that's true whether it falls into the official disability camp or just like you're a student, because everyone has different strengths and weaknesses. So I think having that kind of individualized, sensitive approach is the one thing that, it's a big thing that I don't think is like kind of the easiest thing to internalize, but that would be the thing.
The one thing.
the big thing.
So that might be an answer to my next question, which is, what can the scientific community do better in particular?
There's a part of me that wants to just like spout out a bunch of ways to be more accessible, of like having, you know, audio description if there's visual content. But I think that is kind of like low-hanging fruit to say, like, be accessible. But I think the other piece of this is that science benefits from diversity. And that's something that I don't think that's a unique story to ability status in any way. It's true of every type of diversity, but that there is a value in having our voices at the table, and we may do things differently. I myself do a lot of things very differently. That's just how it is. But everybody does things differently, and those differences matter, and that actually improves science. And so I would want the idea to, yeah, just be known that, like, diversity is good for science. We need other voices and perspectives.
I guess maybe in grad school, maybe in science in general, what have you found to be the most challenging and frustrating, and what has been helpful in navigating those challenges?
I think the most challenging and frustrating piece has been that there is so little mentorship or guidance or support. I think the unfortunate reality is that living with a disability like mine is oftentimes really isolating as a graduate student, because my experiences are different. And granted, again, everybody has different experiences, so in some ways, like, grad school is just isolating for everyone. But I think in particular, I have a lot of professional development questions related to how do I disclose, or when do I disclose my need for accommodations, or what do I do in this particular hospital context when I don't have an ally or kind of like a clear system to seek support from? And I think those questions are ones that I have a very hard time getting answers to, because no one has experience with this. Literally no faculty member that I've ever worked with, no clinician I've ever worked with, has had either their own lived experience or mentored a student who has a disability as profound as mine. And so it's very difficult when I'm like, so how does tenure work if you can't quite produce at the same rate because of something like a disability? And they kind of like stare at me like, I don't know. And I don't know that anyone can answer that. And you're going to have to figure it out. So good luck. And so I think the challenge of like creating my own path and advocating for myself when, yeah, that I would say is the biggest challenge is, yeah, not having support or mentorship or people who really like know how to help me or are even kind of like willing to have the conversation. I think several of my mentors in particular, like, it's uncomfortable to talk about this and they don't have any answers or solutions. And so there's, I think, sometimes an avoidance of what does this mean to have this aspect of your identity. So I would call that a big challenge. What has been most helpful? I think having a curiosity to understand someone else's lived experience, I think, is like the best way of dealing with any type of like diversity related issue, of just like wanting to understand and wanting to be able to support and however that person needs it. And so for me, what's been the most helpful is my friends and my cohort mates and people in my program who are like, Jen, I want to understand how this impacts you, and I want to empower you to share your experience to help others. So for example, I wrote a paper with one of my peers here who has Tourette syndrome, a neurological condition where, you know, there's like the blurting out loud. We wrote a paper together about what it means to be a graduate student in clinical training dealing with a disability, specifically in terms of how to navigate supervisory relationships, because a lot of supervisors will be like, hey, don't do that Tourette's thing, or like, hey, you're going to have to read your client's paperwork. And it's like, these are not options for people who have these physical limitations. And trying to increase awareness around that, that's something where if I didn't have a peer who had similar types of challenges and who could kind of commiserate with me on this, I don't know that I would have felt empowered to share these narratives around these experiences. So I think the most helpful thing is wanting to understand and then trying to empower those voices.
Speaking of sharing your experiences, you write this really wonderful blog about being a blind scientist. How did you get started with that?
When I first came to graduate school, I took a professional development class that encouraged writing. And the idea behind the class was like, do as much writing as you can. And it can be a blog, it can be papers, it can be anything. And I was like, you know, I have a lot of thoughts and opinions about disability and what it means to live with this type of experience, particularly in an academic context. And so I decided in my first year of graduate school to start this blog. The blog is titled Voicing Vulnerability. And the idea is that, I mean, it is a practice for myself to voice the vulnerability of what it is that I'm experiencing. But my goal is to use my experiences as well as what I've encountered with others as a way to highlight what it means to be a person in academia encountering disability. I kind of like vacillate about what my exact mission is on my blog, and I have done some guest writing on other blogs and that sort of thing. But I think the key for me that feels so important is that there are so few voices that have this type of experience, at least based on what I've been able to find. And I personally have found myself clinging desperately to the narratives that I have been able to find of similar lived experience. There are a couple blind scholars in very different disciplines, but they have written books and that sort of thing. And I find it to be such a lifeline to know that there are other people who have figured this out that are doing this type of work and that are normalizing some of the challenges. And so I couldn't help but think, like, maybe I could do this for others. And who knows? I think sometimes maybe it's like just my close friends who read it occasionally, but still it feels like important work for me and kind of aligned with those goals and values that I have to have these voices out there. So that's why I write it.
Has anyone ever reached out to you?
I have had probably, I don't know, like half a dozen to a dozen people reach out saying like, yeah, I'm dealing with some type of chronic illness or I'm dealing with some type of chronic disability. And I have felt like there was no one else going through this. And I think in particular with chronic illness, it is something that a lot of people are struggling with in silence. And so it's something that is really powerful for me to feel as though this is something that is connecting with other people. And those times that people do reach out to me, I mean, that's the most powerful. The message that I've gotten most from other people is like, this is giving me permission to share my story. And again, like that is just so profound if I can have that effect on anyone. And I would say one of the other additional benefits of this is that it has led to me connecting with a lot of other people who have similar types of lived experience. In particular, there are two other visually impaired students who work in the same building as me, and I didn't know. And of course, we didn't know each other. We're in different areas. And let me tell you, it is very hard for us to meet up because none of us can find each other. But aside from that technicality, it is absolutely fantastic to have other humans that are looking at similar ideas and in a similar stage of life. And that has been something that has been so helpful for me to, again, kind of like normalize this experience. And I was mentioning earlier how isolating it can be to have these types of challenges that others are not encountering. And so to have a way to connect with others with similar experiences has been really, really profound. That's not why I started writing my blog, to say the least, but having those points of connection have been, yeah, just really special.
Would you continue doing advocacy like this? After you graduate, after your internship?
Yeah, it's something that I'm really interested in. And I've always really loved writing, and I could see myself at some point putting this all into a book of some kind. And it's something that I think, you know, based on how busy I am, it sort of impacts how regularly I post. But it is something that it's still a core thread that I'm really passionate about. And so whether it's through the form of blogging or in other forms of advocacy, I have been involved in other types of community efforts on this front. And that's something that I think will always be part of what I do.
So I wanted to ask if you think there is a quote-unquote perfect way of bringing attention to someone's like different trait. Like for me, I'm Asian, so I hear a fair amount of like, oh, well, not to be racist, but, or something, something Asians, but, oh, not you. And I find that it is usually from people who do have good intentions, but saying those things tells me that you do see me as different. And to me, that is worse than a genuinely ignorant question. But that said, I also find myself not knowing how to approach others about their situations. So, like, for this podcast, I wasn't sure how to bring up your being blind without being, like, offensive. And I didn't know how to ask the right questions, even though this was something that I really wanted to talk about because it's so important, both to you and speaking about accessibility in the greater context of academia. But yeah, so how do you prefer someone approach you about your disability?
Maybe this is my like thick skin over the years of having lots of like, you know, comments thrown my way, but like I would much rather have the clumsy, awkward, for kind of like laughing as we're fumbling through conversation as opposed to like not talking about it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there is like a perfect way that like there is no good way. Like anytime we're having these conversations about like identity, every person is different too. Like, I don't know how savvy you guys are about like language use and disability, like first person versus identity first. Different communities have different preferences. And so this is the part that's so difficult. Like the kind of standard scientifically is to have what's called person first language, where you would say like a person with a disability or a person who's experiencing vision loss, as opposed to saying like the blind people or whatever. And this is something where different communities feel very differently. Some, particularly blindness and deafness, are communities where they're kind of like, no, this is so central to who I am. Like, I actually want you to consider my identity first because I am a blind person. That is accurate. Whereas other communities, like in mental health in particular, that's one where this idea of first person language is a little bit more, I would say, like, taboo. Like saying someone is a schizophrenic is not a cool thing to say. You would say like they are a person who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia or is experiencing symptoms of schizophrenia. But so anyway, like that type of language use, there is no right answer because different communities feel differently and different people within those communities feel differently. And so that's where I'm kind of like, just ask the person what you want, what you like. And like, maybe you don't like to be referred to as Asian. Maybe you prefer to be referred to as like Chinese Canadian. I don't know. But like, I would need to ask you that to know what you're most comfortable with.
So how do you refer to yourself then?
It's actually funny. This was like probably my second or third blog post ever. I wrote about my progression of changing the language that I use that has coincided with the progression of my visual disability, but also the progression of my own ownership of my disability. And so I used to do a lot of kind of like word vomiting of like, I am a person who has this form of legal blindness, who like trying to really hedge around the fact that like I am disabled. Now I will flat out say I am disabled. I have a disability. The one thing I do struggle with is the distinction between blind and legally blind, because a lot of people who are fully blind, like have no sight of colors or shapes or anything, they find it kind of offensive that someone like me would say that I'm blind, because I do still have a decent degree of peripheral vision. And so I do tend to gravitate towards partially sighted or low vision as opposed to blind. But sometimes like people don't really understand what that means. And blindness, I think, has a little bit more of a punch sometimes. So if, especially I'm trying to get an accommodation, for example, I'll use the word blind. So it also depends on my goal of the interaction.
Sight dominant was a word that I've heard people use to describe people who do have like the full
fully sighted
vision. How you interact with the world is your sight first.
I love that.
That was great. And low vis, like low vision or low vis, is what I first heard. As you talk to people, you just pick up the vocabulary that they're using, and you're like, oh, I like sight dominant, because it also doesn't like have a deficit.
And it'd be the same way, like if I were to say I'm hearing dominant, because that is the sense that I rely on the most. I like that, though. I don't know that fits all that well for a lot of people.
Right. Or more so just to contrast with like if you're in the deaf community, which, as you know, we don't have a disability, we have a different way of communicating. And I think autism has really also kind of moved into that arena of like, we are communicating.
Diversity, like,
right.
We are just doing our own thing.
Yeah. And so like, you're not, it's instead of being like, oh, you are lacking vision, it's like you happen to just navigate through the world mostly visually. And so I liked that particular language
I really like that language, and it's so consistent with, like, the disability studies community, like, people who are like, we're going to look at disability culture. The big mission is, like, to signal this isn't, like, it is a deficit. It's like, you are a square peg in a round hole. Like, I am in the round hole society of sighted people, but I am a square peg. There is nothing wrong with me or my abilities. It's just that I am misaligned with the environment or what most people tend to have. And I think that view of it is one that, oh my gosh, it's helped me in my self-worth. But I think it's one that's really important for a lot of people. Yeah. Of like, yeah, no, you're not deficient. There's nothing wrong with you. You just do things differently, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and like, sure, there are strategies to help you hurt yourself less and hurt other people less, but like, so what if you're experiencing some different type of experience than other people? There's nothing wrong with that. Non-judgmental.
So, I guess to get you to say it, where can people find your blog?
So my blog can be found at voicingvulnerability.blogspot.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Jen Perlstein.
This episode was produced by me, Cindy Liu, with help from Anna Lipkin and the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Thank you so much to Jen Perlstein for her time and to you for listening. Check out the show notes on our website, carrytheoneradio.com, for links to Jen's blog and writing. Thanks especially to David Cabral, Janine Cuevas, Carly Van Orsdale, and Sama Ahmed for supporting us as science producers on our Patreon. If you'd like to support us by donating as well, you can head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. We've got patron rewards at every supporter level, and we're grateful for any amount of support. Otherwise, tell your friends about us. Leave us a review. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and start a conversation. We've got lots more content over on our website, and you can find all of our episodes on your favorite podcast app. Check back in 2 weeks when we'll talk about what earthquakes and volcanoes can teach us about the interior of the Earth. And as always, stay curious.